The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Made possible by the support of the Marin Electric Company and Woundedware. This program is a part of the Museum and Library's exhibit, Seal the Unspoken Sacrifice, featuring photographs and artifacts about U.S. Navy SEALs and their families.
Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents, featuring former Navy SEAL officer Jason Redman. I'm your host, Ken Clark. This program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago and is sponsored by the Marin Electric Company and by Woundedware, a not-for-profit organization that provides free clothing and modifications to wounded warriors and raises national awareness for their sacrifice. Later on, we'll be taking questions from our studio audience and from those of you joining us online at PritzkerMilitary.org. Decorated U.S. Navy SEAL Lieutenant Jason Redman served his country courageously and with distinction in Colombia, Peru, Afghanistan, and Iraq, where he commanded mobility and assault forces. While leading a mission in Iraq in 2007, Jason's SEAL team was ambushed, and he was shot twice in the arm and once in the face. During the intense recovery period that followed, he gained national attention when he posted a sign on his door at the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, warning all who entered not to feel sorry for his wounds. Jason's sign became both a statement and a symbol for wounded warriors everywhere. He joins us to discuss his book, The Trident, The Forging and Reforging of a Navy SEAL Leader. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, Jason Redman.
Thank you. Ken, thanks for the introduction. Pritzker Library, I'm honored to be here. Thank you, guys. And I also want to thank Marin Electric, I mean, obviously, for bringing me in. I got some of my friends out there, so thank you guys for coming. I'll send you the check. So, you know, this is a really amazing place to be. I got to tell you, as I walked in, immediately I already saw guys on the walls in these pictures that I served with, and it carried even heavier weight as I walked into this adjacent room, and there's stories that are written on the walls by the wives of some of my fallen teammates. And it really hits you and makes you understand that there's a lot of sacrifice that went into this country to build it into what it is. And it's captured on these walls. It's captured inside this building. So it truly is a great tribute here in Chicago, you know, what is it about. So I want to thank all of you for just having me here. Do we have any veterans in the room tonight? So those of you that are veterans, I want to thank you for your service. I had the great honor of serving with almost every single branch of the military. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind the United States of America has one of the greatest militaries in the world. The level of professionalism and selflessness that is displayed in our military is truly unparalleled. So thank you to all of you guys. Today, what I'm hoping to share with you is many of the lessons that I learned throughout my 21-year career. I truly had a very unique career forged and reforged by adversity. I had the honor of being given a second chance at life. And it was during that time that I started to reflect that it really made me think back on everything that I had done, the positive, the negative, the good, the bad. And because I couldn't write in the beginning, because of my facial injuries, it grew from the notes that I had to write down, because that was my only way to communicate. And by the time I left the hospital, by the time I finally was able to speak again, I had over 500 handwritten pages of totally incoherent notes. I mean, it's pretty interesting to go through. I think maybe on about three pages I put dates. But beyond that, it was just massive amounts of information. And I would, you know, it was everything from, hey, can you bring me some water, to, hey, I'm in a lot of pain, I need pain meds, to I started writing down what happened in that firefight and how we overcame it and how we looked at different things. And that became lessons I had learned in Afghanistan. And it all came together, all these adventure stories, lessons on leadership and overcoming adversity. And I started writing also about the love and support of my wife and family as I went through my entire career, and especially after I'd been wounded. So I never really intended to write a book. A near-death experience and having a lot of time on my hand kind of led to that, and of course being forced to write. So it was kind of interesting as I shared some of these notes and I started to organize my thoughts. I had friends that would read it, and they said, you really got to do something with this. Books within the SEAL community are kind of an interesting thing. We really pride ourselves on being the quiet professionals. We really pride ourselves on trying to stay in the shadows, which I know is a little hard to believe in this current day and age where we have all these movies and books and there's a lot of fanfare about the SEAL teams. So it was a real big deal for me to try and capture whether I was going to move forward and write a book or not. You know, at one point in my career, I got myself in quite a bit of trouble and really damaged my reputation. And I'm one of the few guys from our community that really redeemed myself and came back and left the community very highly respected. And the last thing I wanted to do was damage my reputation by being one of those guys that came out with a book that was not supported and endorsed by the community. So I started to seek out all of the leaders that I could find. You know, these key leaders, our senior enlisted, our senior officers, and I said, hey, I want to show you something. I've started to reflect on my career. I've started to reflect on the lessons that I've had as a SEAL. I wonder what you think about this. And some of these key leaders looked at it and they said, this is good. It reflects well on the community. It's good lessons. It's humble in nature. It adheres to our tenets that the deed is all, not the glory. One of the people I reached out to was Secretary Gates, who I had the honor to meet during my recovery and be invited to the Pentagon with my family. So I had reached back out to him through a friend, and I said, would you be willing to endorse this book? I served under you, I met you, and I was pretty surprised. I had sent him a copy of the manuscript. It was probably less than 2 weeks, maybe even only a week, when I got a reply back, and he said, Jay, I love your book. I love the tone. Not only will I endorse it, I'll write your foreword, and that's how that came to be. Another interesting connection to the book was Admiral Eric Olson endorsed my book. And for those of you that don't know Admiral Olson was the former Special Operations Commander prior to Admiral McRaven. So he was in charge of all Special Operations Forces around the world, in the United States. And Admiral Olson is very well known for being the consummate quiet professional, from constantly shunning the spotlight, doesn't really like publicity. And I had some of our senior leaders say, you know, if you're really looking for a big endorsement for your book that says it's been supported by the community, you should reach out to Admiral Olson. So I did, and I fully expected him to write me back and say, hey, Jay, I know you know where I stand on this. I think you've got a great story, but it's just how I am. But he didn't. He actually wrote back and he said, I like your story. I think it's good. I think we need to tell stories like this. I think the American people need to be aware of stories like this. So I've been pretty blessed with the support that this book has brought, given, you know, the nature of special operations. The last big win we had is just last month, Admiral Jonathan Greener, who is our current Chief of Naval Operations, released his official reading list for the United States Navy for 2014. And they select these books based off leadership, based off what's going to set good examples and lessons for the future leaders of the United States Navy that's going to capture our history. And they only picked 5 books for 2014, so I was honored that the Trident was selected for one of those. So I'm going to read my intro right from the beginning of the book, and I think it truly captures why I chose to write the book, and then I'm going to go into my journey of how I grew up in the teams and how many of the things unfolded to create the person that's standing in front of you today. So, U.S. Navy SEAL teams have received unprecedented exposure over the last several years. A small segment of the community welcomed the exposure, while the vast majority wish all the attention would go away. Adhering to the original humble roots of the SEAL teams, which holds on to the tenet, the deed is all, not the glory. Every man who has decided to talk has his reasons to do so. I originally chose not to, but as I began to speak to friends and leaders about my personal journey, they encouraged me to share my story. Over the last 4 years, I've had ample time to reflect on my 21-year career in the SEAL teams. I served in Iraq and Afghanistan and various hotspots in South and Central America during deployments both pre and post 9/11. I took pride in my accomplishments, But I also forced myself to face difficult truths about who I was when I was a younger man. I gleaned lessons from my own experience as I spent long weeks and months in hospital beds around the United States. I wish I'd paused and been more contemplative earlier in my life. And so I wrote this book to be both a signpost toward a successful future and a cautionary tale of arrogance and impetuousness. I grew up in a community of hardened warriors, but I possessed an immaturity that lingered far too long. Hard lessons showed me the right path, and with help from admirable and respected friends, I found myself taking it. In time, I learned the true meaning of leadership and the responsibility required to lead men into battle. Today, I look back and feel supremely honored to have been with men far better than me on missions bigger than all of us. Many of the SEAL books written over the years have portrayed us as these infallible machines. We are not. We are humans driven to achieve and be the best at what we do, but still humans, complete with all the frailties built into our species. How we manage those frailties is one of the reasons for our success. My story embodies that reality and how I overcame my own shortcomings. Being a SEAL took me to the edge and beyond. It shaped me into who I am today. When I look back, I liken my path to that of an ancient sword being made into an effective combat weapon. I was selected and hardened, hammered and sharpened until I was finally used in battle. But the rigors of combat revealed my flaws, and I was broken. A second chance reforged me into a true leader and allowed me the honor of fighting alongside some of the greatest warriors this nation has ever produced. This is my story. This is my journey. September of 2007, on one of the last missions of our deployment to the Al-Anbar province of Iraq. It was a very active time in the Anbar province. It was during a time known as the Anbar Awakening, for those of you who remember it. The end of 2006, a really volatile time in Iraq, and the insurgency and Al-Qaeda were really pushing hard out in Ramadi, in Fallujah, and a lot of the regions around that area. There was some very, very intense fighting. Thankfully, some of the local sheikhs finally stepped up and said, "We've had enough. We're not going to put up with this. It's time that we stepped up and started to support the coalition forces." And it was during that time that we really started to receive the support of the Iraqi people, which enabled us to go out there and take down the enemy. It occurred in Ramadi. Chris Kyle talks a lot about that in the Battle of Ramadi. Dick Couch talks about it in the Sheriff of Ramadi. And we were definitely seeing it in Fallujah. It was an incredibly active deployment. Our task unit alone did probably over 80 direct action missions around Fallujah, outside of Fallujah, and all throughout Al-Anbar. On that night, we had been tracking a very high-level Al-Qaeda leader throughout that deployment. And every time we had gone into certain areas that he'd been working in, we had gotten into a firefight. We had several guys wounded earlier in the deployment. On one of the original missions, the very first mission, the turnover op that we did, going after that specific cell, we had lost a SEAL. Petty Officer Clark Swedler was killed on that mission, and several other members of our team were severely wounded. So we were pretty anxious to get this guy. And it was late at night, close to midnight, when we were notified, hey, that top leader you guys have been tracking this whole deployment is in a specific location. It's going to be a time-sensitive target, meaning we had very little time to assemble our gear and get out there and try and make it there before this guy moved from that position that we were given information that he was at. I was tasked to be the assault force commander in charge of the direct assault itself, the assault team that was taking down the building that he was in, and we had a separate assault team that was tasked with providing the external security. They would lock down that target and make sure that nobody could get in. And make sure they protected us if anybody came to try and attack that building while we were inside taking down and trying to capture or neutralize this Al-Qaeda leader. Came in on the helicopters and best laid plans of mice and men, of course, in the chaos of combat, everything kind of got turned around. We had originally planned that our breacher, team leader, point man would be on the door facing the helicopter door facing the door of the structure so that once we landed, it was a straight shot into that door. The guys could breach and go in. Myself and the team leader were all the way on the other side so that we could flow that assault team in. Obviously, chaos of war, the helicopter actually landed the opposite way. So I found myself and my team leader facing the door, and it was go time. There was no time to wait. You know, with the helicopters coming in, the enemy gets a vote. They know at least a minute out that somebody's coming in after them. So my team leader and I ran up to that door. He was the first man. I was the second. Prepped a grenade, rolled it into that building, and we made entry. I've never made an entry before in my life that I fully expected. I could just feel every muscle tense as I flowed into that room, fully expecting machine gun fire to just rip me apart. Thankfully, that didn't happen. The rest of the team came in behind us. We ended up clearing the entire structure, and there was nobody there. Signs of life, signs of activity. Obviously, we had just missed this guy. Started finding a lot of anti-American, anti-coalition propaganda, and finished our clearance, target secure. External security started searching through the courtyard. They started finding all kinds of stuff. Weapons, RPGs, munitions, 155 rounds buried in the courtyard outside, in the walls, buried in the ground. So they started collecting all this stuff. My team was stood down at that point. We were just kind of waiting for them to complete their clearance, for us to assemble the munitions. And we were going to do something called a BIP, a blow in place, take all that stuff out. And we were going to pull out, and that was going to be the end of our night. We were sitting there for about 30 minutes, myself and my team, as we waited. And we got word that there was quite a bit of movement and activity on a house about 150 yards to the north of where we were. This is unusual at this time of night in Iraq. Now, granted, we came in with helicopters, but this movement was not the movement of somebody that's inside their house peeking out to see what's going on. It's the movement of somebody that is moving towards a position of tactical advantage. So the ground force commander came up to me and said, hey, I want you to take your guys. I want you to move on that target and go out there, where these guys had now at this point moved into a field of very dense vegetation across from this house that they had just come out of. I took my team and we maneuvered out. There were nine of us at this point, and we started moving through this very dense vegetation. And at this point, we now had the AC-130 gunship up above vectoring us towards the enemy fighters. Constantly, you see any weapons, you know, what are we seeing? We were getting nothing at this point. We don't see anything. They've gone to ground. They're not moving. It looks like they're just laying there. We were told it was four or five individuals at this point. As we moved through this field, we were moving online at this point, and we were told, hey, you need to make a turn. You're going to miss the individuals. We went to make that turn, and our three individuals on that left flank unfortunately missed that call. So we now had a split in our forces. We had six forces moving to the northeast. We had three forces that were continuing to move north. And in my mind, what I immediately recognized when I saw this about 15 seconds later is we had an unknown enemy force in between us. We were now in about the worst situation you can be in combat, which is the potential for a blue-on-blue, meaning that American forces can shoot on themselves and potentially hurt our own men. Got a hold of the guys that had split, told them they needed to push out to the west. My guys on the easternmost flank identified, hey, I'm on the edge of this field. I can push out here. We said, okay, we're going to push out both sides. We're going to move up to the front of the field. We're going to come back, regroup, and then we'll push back in to try and wrap up these four or five individuals that are hiding in this vegetation. As we got to the edge of that field, one of our last guys was about 5 yards of stepping out of that vegetation. I had already come out and was making my turn to move back to the front of that field when literally one of our SEALs stepped on the enemy fighter. Immediately engaged him and the firefight was on. There were at least, as far as we know of, 7 to 10 enemy fighters hidden in fighting positions along an ambush line. There were two PKM machine guns, which is a very large caliber machine gun, similar to an M60, and multiple guys with AKs. Thankfully, our guys that had separated over to the west quickly recognized they were out of the fight, and they pulled themselves back. Unfortunately, from my position, all I could think about is we were shooting back towards those guys. So I immediately started yelling, hey, you got to know what you're shooting at. Make sure you know what you're shooting at. That drew a lot of attention in that moment, and suddenly I had that machine gun turned directly on me. I was only about 45 feet from that machine gun, which, you know, it's about the width of this room. That, it's a pretty unpleasant feeling to have a large caliber machine gun suddenly open up directly on you. Bullets, very high velocity rounds, you actually hear the supersonic crack of the bullet before you actually hear the explosion of the gunpowder coming out of the gun. So it's an interesting thing. You hear this crack, and then you'll hear the explosion because the bullet's obviously traveling faster than the speed of sound. Well, imagine hearing that all around you as this guy was trying to spray towards me. Our medic was immediately hit in that firefight. I myself was stitched in the first minutes across the body armor. I took 2 rounds in the left elbow, and immediately it stunned my nerves. All of you guys have hit your funny bone once or twice, right? So it felt like an 800-pound gorilla had whacked me in the funny bone. It stunned me all the way up to the base of my skull. And when I reached over, I didn't realize it, but what had happened is when I got shot in the arm, my arm actually caught on my gear. And I couldn't feel anything, so I thought in that moment that my arm had been shot off. I immediately was getting calls on the radio. We had other guys hit, and it was chaos. We're trying to shoot. We have an unknown enemy force. All I see in front of me are muzzle flashes as they're trying to engage us. Immediately tried to engage the enemy. I knew that I only had a couple of minutes, that I had to get a tourniquet on my arm. We're trained in the military, especially in special operations, that you have to save yourself. You cannot. We have learned this lesson over and over again throughout history and in combat, that you cannot stop and run out in the middle of a firefight to save your buddy, because all you're going to do is risk the chance that you yourself are now going to be hit. And now we have multiple individuals wounded out there. So we have to teach each other individual aid, and then buddy aid, and then you get your corpsman or medic to be able to provide that service before we can bring in a medevac. You have to win the fight first. So that was my immediate thought. I was taking very heavy fire at this point. I was taking fire off my body armor. I started taking fire. I was shooting. I was taking fire off my weapon. I had my flashlight shot off my gun. I took a round off my helmet. I had my left night vision tube shot off. To this day, I don't know how many rounds I took off my front plate because I never got it back. Took rounds off my right side plate. Dropped to the ground, started trying to get my tourniquet on, and it's amazing how much blood you lose when you've obviously been shot by a high caliber weapon. I didn't know it at the time, but I had taken 2 rounds, one above the elbow, one below the elbow. I was losing a lot of blood, and I was too weak actually to break these big rubber bands that were on my chest, holding my tourniquet in place. And as I lay there seeing these rounds travel over me, I decided my best bet was to try to get back to the team that was about 15 yards behind me in this open field. The only point of cover they had was this big tractor tire, one of those big Caterpillar-type tractor tires, probably about 10 feet by, 3 feet off the ground. And all the guys had managed to fall back. They had pulled our other 2 wounded members back behind that tire, and I was still out front about 15 yards away. So I made a decision. My best bet was to try and get up and run back to that tractor tire. And it was in that moment, as I stood up, the guy saw me stand up, that the machine gun opened up on me again. And I took a round right from behind that caught me directly in front of the ear, traveled out, and out the right side of my nose, knocked me out. I came to, and I couldn't quite put coherent thoughts together. I realized that something was seriously wrong, but I couldn't quite figure out what it is. I never realized I was unconscious. For me, it was a constant stream of consciousness. I just kind of realized, okay, I'm still on the ground. But I knew something was wrong. I couldn't think straight. I couldn't put thoughts together. And as I lay there, and it was a very dark night, it's probably 4 a.m. at this point, I reached up and I touched my face. And when I brought my hand back with my glove, I could tell my glove was totally soaked. It was totally dark. And I knew at that point that I'd been shot in the face. The firefight was still raging. Called out to my teammates, my team leader, Al, and I said, Al, I've been shot in the face. How long to the medevac? And thankfully, he called me back, and they couldn't believe that I was alive, because what had really happened is they saw me get up, they saw me get hit and drop in front of them, and they thought I was dead. I actually had ended up being unconscious for about 5 minutes before I came to, so they didn't even think I was still around. So they were pretty amazed when I came to in that moment and started calling out to them. I remember watching the fire missions come down. It was an intense firefight. We were only 45 feet away from the machine guns and the enemy that was engaging us. And Al started calling these fire missions. And in the military, munitions have an explosive radius when they go off. We call it danger close is the term in the military. So when we call in anything from smaller caliber rounds like a 25 millimeter chain gun or larger caliber rounds like the 40 millimeter gun on the gunship or even the really big rounds, the 105 howitzer rounds that it fires, there are certain distances that we have to be to ensure that friendly forces don't get fragged from those munitions as they come in. So as that occurred, we started calling in, or Al started calling in those fire missions, and they said, there is no way. We will kill you guys. You guys are so far within the danger close parameters, we cannot bring that fire mission in. So the fight continued to rage on. Al called back maybe 5 minutes later, that probably seemed like 5 hours to them, and said, I need you to bring in this fire mission. He said, I've got two severely wounded, one critically wounded. I don't know if he's going to make it, talking about me. Gunship said, once again, we don't have the ability to bring it in. We will kill you guys. Finally, the third time, Al called, and he said, listen, there's not going to be anybody left. We have no place to go. I got guys bleeding out. Finally, that gunship said, okay, you know, but we're putting it on you. You know, you got to assume responsibility. If anything goes wrong, anything that goes wrong, it's on your head. Al made the call, started walking those rounds in, and I remember laying there literally watching the tracer rounds hit the ground in front of us, and it's an amazing thing when a 25-millimeter chain gun, I mean, these are big bullets, come out of the sky. We call it the dragon's breath because it makes this amazing sound like, and you can actually feel the overpressure, I mean, especially when it's only 45 feet in front of you, as it hits the ground, and I could feel the ground shake underneath me as these rounds struck. We ended up calling in five fire missions, which ultimately saved our lives. In between the second fire mission, I'm fortunate that Al ran forward and managed to grab me and drag me back in the middle of that firefight. I'd never got my tourniquet on. I was danger close to bleeding out. And he got me back behind the tire and put that tourniquet on. Saved my life. Got it in my mind that I had to stay awake in order to stay alive. And thankfully, about 35 minutes occurred from the beginning of the firefight to the end when the helicopter was called in. The medevac helicopter managed to neutralize all the enemy fighters that were there, secure the scene, and bring in that medevac. And Al came up to me and started dragging me. The helicopter landed about 75 yards from my position. And I told him to stop. It was incredibly painful, you know, getting my arm dragged in that moment. And I said, just help me up. Let me get up. I got up, and I still in my mind had thought that I had lost my arm with my clouded judgment getting my bell rang. So I told Al, and for whatever crazy reason, I took my helmet off in the middle of a firefight, which took another round directly through it during the engagement. So thankfully, my head wasn't in it, but I mean, who does that? Who decides in the middle of a fierce firefight, I got a great idea. Let me take my helmet off that's protecting me. But I set it next to me, and I remember hearing the sound when the bullet hit it. But when Al went to grab me, I said, hey, grab my arm and grab my helmet and help me get out of here. And that's exactly what happened. So got to the helicopter, flew at breakneck speed, and arrived at Baghdad. You know, the cache at Baghdad, pretty critical at that point. And still trying to keep it in my mind, if you can stay awake, you're going to stay alive. For those of you who don't know, the military medical system, the trauma medical system in the military is unparalleled in the world in this day and age. If you get wounded on the battlefield since about 2003, and you can make it to the cache, the emergency room in Baghdad or Bagram, you have a 97% chance of making it. So that's what was in my mind. I've got to stay awake. I've got to stay alive. If I can make it there, I'm going to make it. So we got there. I was drifting in and out of consciousness. I wasn't aware of it, but in my mind, I was staying awake. And they finally wheeled me into the operating room. There's all these bright lights. I felt people. Before I went in there, they started cutting off all my gear. Because obviously they don't want the doctors or nurses to be cut on a knife, or they don't want any bullets. They don't want anything dangerous in the operating room as they're trying to save our lives. And they finally got me in there. There's all these lights. I felt all these people rush on top of me. And I thought to myself, okay, I can let go. I can die, and they will save me. I can give in to this dark angel that's hovering around me right now. And as I started to drift off, I always kept a grenade on my belt, my last-ditch grenade, just in case the world went to hell. I had something that I could try and make a last stand with. And they had missed that. So as I'm laying there, the young gal next to me, and I hope someday I meet this person. I want them to come out so they can tell me what they really said. Because in my mind, what I heard was, he's still got a bomb on him. And it looked like something out of a cartoon. Like literally all I saw were puffs of dust in every direction as the room cleared. And I thought to myself, you got to be kidding me. I'm dying here. Come save me. And that is the last thing I remember. When I woke up, alive, and it was a drift. You know, I was on very heavy drugs. I came to find out that I had not lost my arm. I came to find out I had suffered massive damage to my face. I was trached. My jaw was wired shut. I had no use of, even though I still had my arm, I had no use of anything on my left arm. And they were telling me there was a good chance they were going to have to amputate my arm when I got home. But that they were packaging me and trying to get me back to the States. I woke up again, and apparently I had been moved to Balad. I have no memory of that ever happening. And I woke up in Balad, and at this point, I woke up, and my guys were around me. My platoon had jumped on a helicopter to come up and visit with me. And in the room next to me in the ICU, there was a young Army private first class, maybe, that had been struck by an IED. He had suffered massive head injuries and was barely clinging to life. And unfortunately, in a special operations unit, we have the ability to have more access to assets. We have the ability to move around the battlefield in a much easier manner than conventional military units do. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, this young Army kid had not had members of his unit there with him, or at least in my mind, at no point did I see anybody there. Maybe they were there, but I didn't see them. I could only see them kind of next to me and not seeing anybody. And my guys were there next to me, and they were talking about the firefight, and they were doing what warriors do, which is make fun of each other, you know, heckle me for moving too slow, heckle me for being such a wuss and not getting out of the bed, hit on the nurses, you know, make fun of the doctors, you know, just trying to keep the mood light. And it was an interesting thing because I lay there in that moment in that bed and I looked over at that young Army soldier next to me. I thought to myself, if this had happened a couple of years ago, I might not have had my brother sitting here next to me. Because you see, earlier in my career, I'd failed to understand what it is to be a good leader. I'd failed to understand what it is to lead men into combat in situations like that. I'd focused too much on myself and my own advancement than I did on what it is to accomplish the mission and what it is to lead men and inspire them and look out for them. Everybody knows these type of people. They're the type of people that accomplish the mission or task. They're good at what they do. They can be abrasive. They can leave a path of destruction in their wake. And I had been that young man. At times, I like to call it the leadership wrecking ball. They're that person that gets things done, but man, they will crush everything in their path. When I look back on my career, there was a story when I was a young man where we went and we took down, it was a pretty amazing training mission, probably the coolest training mission I ever did. We were tasked to actually break into NASA at Cape Canaveral. And we went in by a diving excursion. We had several different dive pairs, and each dive pair was tasked to take down a specific target within NASA. NASA's security forces were on high alert, trying to stop us, of course. They had no idea on how we may or may not come in there. So we came in by dive and swimming with a whole bunch of alligators, which is another story. But we were told, these are the areas that you're going to go into, and we were also briefed, these are areas that you are not allowed to go into. Do not go into these areas. They are off limits for the exercise purposes. I went in. I hit my target with my partner. We maneuvered back out. We made our extract. Everybody had gone in. At the debrief, we found out that one of our other teammates had managed to decide that he was going to be smart, and he broke into one of the on one of the restricted areas that he wasn't supposed to go into. Cut a fence, went in there, planted his charges, and basically said, hey, look at me. Look how we showed you up, NASA. And I remember as a young man thinking, that is awesome. We are so great. Failing to recognize as a young man and a future leader, you know, the necessity to massage the relationships that are out there, the necessity to work with people. We burned the bridge in that moment, and I, to this day, I don't think that we've gone back and ever worked with NASA. You know, but it was a lesson that I failed to understand. Fast forward about 10 years, I was, you know, I had excelled in my career. I was that guy that always got it done, but I left a path of destruction behind me. But I was smart enough that I had earned my commission, I'd excelled, I graduated summa cum laude. I was the battalion commander of my ROTC unit before I came back to my SEAL team as a young junior officer. And I had it in my mind with all this prior enlisted experience that I was going to excel as a leader. The guys were going to follow me because I knew what I was doing. I had the experience. And I kind of thought that that was all I needed. If I got things done, guys would follow me. The only problem was the world had changed overnight. I had served in a pre-9/11 military up to that point. And while I was at school, those terrorists had driven their planes into our towers and dropped them, and the war on terror had begun. And at the point prior to me going to school, very few SEALs had combat experience. On those 3 years that I was gone, as I got my commission in 2004, I stepped back into a SEAL team that now had many hardened guys that had been at war. And we had rewritten all our tactics because we still had been operating off the old Vietnam-era tactics. And we realized that those tactics in that environment 30 years ago, 35, 40 years ago, they didn't work on the battlefields of Iraq, and they didn't work in the ambiguous areas of Afghanistan. So everything got changed. So I found myself struggling to keep up. I found myself struggling to be a leader. And instead of embracing it, instead of trying to humble myself and say, hey, how can I learn from you? How can I learn this? Instead, I did the exact opposite. I got ornery. I got ticked off. I found myself drinking a little too much with the guys and really was starting to damage my credibility as a leader. It all came to a head right before we deployed. We were in Germany, and on June 28, 2005, we got word that our task unit, we were split at this point. One part of the platoon was in Germany, and we were doing maritime interdiction operations. The other platoon was in Afghanistan doing combat operations. And on June 28th, we got word that one of the helicopters that our guys were on had been shot down, and that there was a group of individuals that had been in a fierce firefight that were missing. And we all hung sitting there, you know, in the talk in Germany trying to find out, who is it? You know, these were all guys we had fought with, trained with, served with. Several of them were good friends of mine. And the word came back in, you know, the names started coming out. Lieutenant Commander Eric Christensen, our task unit commander. Lieutenant Mike McGreevy, a good friend of mine. Started finding out that the guys on the ground, Petty Officer Marcus Luttrell was missing. Petty Officer Danny Dietz. Petty Officer Matt Axelson, and Lieutenant Mike Murphy. So we sat there and waited, and we were immediately told, get your stuff ready. You guys are going to be flying to Afghanistan immediately. Stand by. And we waited. Several members of our platoon deployed, and we waited. And we got word that finally Marcus Luttrell had been recovered, and that they had recovered the bodies of Danny Dietz and Michael Murphy, and they still had not recovered the bodies of Petty Officer Matt Axelson yet. We got word that Marcus was flying into Landstuhl, so we jumped in our vehicle, myself and some of our teammates, and we headed immediately up to Landstuhl. We met Marcus and talked to him for just a couple minutes, and then we also went and relieved the guys that had escorted home, Mike and Danny. Came back that next day, flew out immediately for Afghanistan, landed on the ground, and the recovery operations were still underway. It was almost 2 days later that they found the body of Matt Axelson. And that was my first introduction to combat, was the ramp ceremony for an American hero as they sent Matt home. and then we honored all of our fallen warriors, there at the Jesotef, these 11 men that we had lost. And you would think that that would have woken me up as a young leader, but instead it just kind of drove my convictions that I wanted to get out there. I wanted to take the fight to the enemy. And that was my desire throughout that deployment. It was a very emotional deployment after we had lost all these guys. It was an interesting time in the war because the leadership at that point was kind of just trying to say, we want to draw this back down. And unfortunately, that had not... the enemy was still out there, but the leadership had decided we want to try and slow it down. So we weren't allowed to go out and do quite a bit of things. Finally, towards the end of that deployment, we were sent down to Kandahar to work in the Helmand province, which is a very volatile area of Afghanistan. We were told that this area that we were going into had had many, many, many firefights. The enemy fighters that were down there, the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban forces, were so brazen, they would come out of their caves and out into the open and try and shoot down helicopters, which is, it's a new level of crazy because, our air assets can swing around and take out people pretty quickly. But it was a large force down there, so we were tasked to go in there, and they wanted us to sweep through this valley, to move through, empty these caves. I was tasked on this mission to be the overwatch commander, to basically have a sniper element and a rocket crew up on a eastern ridge above the valley. We basically locked down this valley on all four sides, and then we pushed an assault team down through the lower valley. As we landed, immediately got into a firefight. We called in some air assets, not my crew, but the guys on the ground. And in this whole deployment, I had yet to actually see direct fire. I'd been on the outskirts. I'd, launched some 40-millimeter rounds and things like that into it, but I wanted to be in the fight. I wanted to be in the mix. As the day waned on after that initial firefight and we got later and later into the day, once again, our group into the ground got into a heavy engagement. And they came across the radio. We just came into contact with 25 to 30 enemy fighters. We needed reinforcements. I was one of the few individuals that still had radio comms with them just because of my placement on that eastern side of the valley and where they were down in that valley floor. This is where young arrogance and desire to get into the fight really started to cloud my judgment. I wanted to prove myself as a leader, so I made the decision to go down into that valley and link up with our guys on the ground. The problem was, once I dropped off that ridgeline, we no longer had communications. And one of the things in combat is complex and chaotic enough as it is. You rarely ever want to give up the high ground unless it's an extreme situation. You don't want to have multiple elements moving at the same time. And you never want to move out of a position when you have air assets overhead. Although I didn't know we had air assets, we did, and that's what they were waiting for. But when we moved down into that valley, we gave up that element until they could make comms with me again. So literally almost 30 minutes went by, which I'm sure seemed like an eternity for the guys in that firefight and the ground force commander. Needless to say, when I finally got comms again, they were breathing fire into the radio. They said, get back up to the other side. I got onto the other side, and the ground force commander came up to me and said, what were you thinking? I said, I was going to the sound of the guns. I was doing what we do. I went to go support our guys. He said, that was a terrible call. You're going to go back to the rear, and you're going to meet with the commanding officer. Problem was, I was really in denial about the whole thing. Instead of really taking a step back and looking at what your job is as a leader, which is to see that whole picture, to look out for everybody in that situation, I kind of had the opposite. I wanted to get into the fight. I wanted to be in the mix. And I was thinking more about myself, and I was thinking much less about the 20 or 30 guys that I really should have been leading. So I stepped in front of the CO, and I was faced with my punishment, which basically they saw potential in me. They saw that 95% of the time I was squared away, but 5% of the time I had those moments where I would give in to that impetuousness, which you can't have as a military leader. And you really don't want to have as any leader. So one of the things that happened is they sent me off to Ranger School. And Ranger School was a tough time for me, not because the school was tough, which it is, but more so because I had failed to really embrace what had happened. I was in this period of denial. And I almost quit. I was angry for being there. It had been that long emotional deployment. And one of the things with Ranger School, I was 13 years into my military career. And when I checked into Ranger School, you no longer can talk to your family. It's only through letters. And I just got off deployment. So needless to say, my wife was not that happy that this was occurring, nor was I. So as I went through Ranger School and it started and I started getting heckled for being a SEAL and I was so bitter about being there, I finally said, you know what? I'm never going to be able to recover my reputation. I'm never going to be able to drive forward as a leader. I might as well just get out. And I went and met with the Ranger Battalion Commander and said, all right, I'm going to get out of here. I got thrown under the bus for a bad decision that really wasn't my fault. I still refused to take ownership for it. And thankfully, it just so happens that this Ranger Battalion Commander happened to be best friends with my mentor, one of the most respected SEALs in the SEAL teams. Guys would follow him anywhere. He was a legendary SEAL. And I didn't want to talk to anybody. And he said, well, you know, I have this one friend. I'm going to call him up. Why don't you talk to him? And it happened to be Captain Vince Peterson, my old mentor. And thankfully, Vince did what he does best. He talked sense into those who lose their way at times, like he had done for me many times before. And he said, get back in that course. Redeem yourself. Overcome. Come back and show what it is to be a good leader and give the guys something to follow. And if you do that, they will follow you. And he was right. And that's what I did. So I redeemed myself and I came back fully understanding what it is to lead, to set the example, to focus on the task, the mission, my people and their needs immediately after that, and then my own needs and desires in the end. This is the example of leadership. This is how you accomplish things. My redemption culminated in a firefight a couple minutes prior to the one that I was wounded in June of 2007. The interesting thing is that journey that I had to go through of making bad decisions, of having to really evaluate myself, the strengths and weaknesses of who I was, and having to really come to grips with being at the bottom of the barrel. I'll admit, there was a point in Afghanistan where I was almost suicidal after everything that had happened. I had really hit rock bottom. But it was that journey that truly enabled me to be able to handle what had happened on that night that I was wounded. I had redeemed my reputation, incredibly successful deployment in Iraq, and then to find myself laying in that hospital bed and how I was going to make it through that. And that journey of going down and climbing back out really made me understand where I needed to go from there. It made me understand one pivotal thing, and that is you can lead from any situation that you're in. It doesn't matter who you are or where you come from. You can lift up those around you, and you can set the example. And I decided to do that from the hospital bed that I was in. All around me in that room were these young Marines and young Army kids, and for whatever reason, they wanted to come meet me. Oh, we want to meet the SEAL that got wounded. And they would come in and say hello, and I couldn't talk. I was kind of a mess. But I realized in that moment, I could have laid there and felt sorry for myself. I could have laid there and said, woe is me, where do I go from here? But instead, I saw a moment. Because of everything that I'd been through before, it made me realize, if you're going to be a leader, lead always. I can make a difference in the lives of these young men that are here with me, and show them that they can drive forward, that they can overcome the amputations that they have and the severe injuries that they're suffering, that their family members were there. And that's how the sign on the door came to be. A couple days after that, I had a couple of people come into my room, and they were beside themselves. I was actually kind of sleeping, which you do a lot after you've been wounded, you know, and have a lot of drugs. So I was kind of drifting off, and they came into the room, and they were talking above my bed. And there was a lot of pity in their voice. They felt sorry for what had happened to me. They wondered, where is he going to go from here? What is he ever going to do? How is he going to move past this? And I kind of woke up and just listened to this. And they left, and my wife came back in the room. And I got my notepad, and I wrote to her, and I said, never again. Never again is anybody going to come into the room feeling sorry for what happened to me. I'm not sorry for myself. What happened happened. It's part of the profession that I chose. It's the unfortunate part of it, but it happened, and I can't go back and change it. And I wrote out this sign, and it said, attention to all who enter here. If you're coming into this room with sorrow or feel sorry for my wounds, go elsewhere. The wounds I received, I got in a job I love, doing it for people I love, supporting the freedom of a country I deeply love. I am incredibly tough and will make a full recovery. What is full? That is the absolute utmost physically my body has the ability to recover. Then I will push that about 20% further through sheer mental tenacity. This room you are about to enter is a room of fun, optimism, and intense rapid regrowth. If you are not prepared for that, go elsewhere. We signed it from the management. A couple days later, a friend of mine took his trident off his chest and he tacked it right into the door at the bottom of the sign. And that sign gained national attention. It went viral. It went all over the place. And I even had the great honor of going to meet President Bush at the White House with my family where he signed it. And what I always like to tell people about that sign and what I did with it after that is this. Everybody wants to make a big deal of, oh, you're the guy that wrote the sign. But here's the reality. If you ever meet any of these wounded warriors that are out there, they're some of the most motivating and inspiring people you will ever meet. You know, that mindset that I wrote on that sign, all I happened to do was capture in writing the mindset of these young American warriors who went out there and fought for this country and sacrificed for it. I captured the mindset of those families who lost a loved one on the battlefield. So we took that sign, we had it framed with President Bush's signature, put all four service emblems in it, put the Afghanistan campaign medal, the Iraq campaign medal, and we put the Purple Heart up at the top. And I wrote some words of encouragement, and then we hung it on the wall and dedicated it at Bethesda Naval Hospital, which later became Walter Reed National Medical Center, where it continues to hang to this day, and it continues to motivate and inspire the young warriors that are going through there as they overcome their own injuries. The last thing I learned as I was going through this journey, I really began to believe that life is about balance and perception, how you perceive life, how you find that balance, the balance between your job, your career, your family, everything you do, you always have to find that balance. If you tilt the scales too far one way or the other, you're going to be out of balance and your life's going to spin out of control. I desired to stay positive. I decided to nurture this relationship with my family. My wife was this incredible, incredible Spartan woman, this rock who never batted an eye as I went through this and raised our children as I underwent 4 years and almost 40 surgeries to get put back together. Almost 20 of them were right here in the great city of Chicago, where they did the nasal reconstruction. So I got to say, I really enjoyed your city in the times that we would get out, just not in the winter. We started trying to avoid the winter surgeries. But when I started to learn about balance and how you look at life, your outlook on life, I met another wounded warrior, another SEAL, a friend of mine, who had been shot in the face like I was. And we came to find out there was another SEAL out there who had been shot in the face. And we became this small club. And we called that club SHIF. And it stood for SEALs Hit in the Head. And we spelled it with great big letters, S-H-I-T, and then we put a real little H, because of course you guys know what that stood for. And then we said, well, what's the club motto? And the motto of our club was, this club sucks. But we became good friends, because all of us were going through the same things. And one of them I became closer than the others in the beginning. I'm close friends with the other guy now, but Ryan Job was his name. And Ryan had fought with legendary sniper Chris Kyle in Ramadi. And Ryan was on a rooftop as a machine gunner when a sniper's bullet struck the buttstock of his machine gun as he was firing. It ricocheted up into his face and fragmented. And it took out his right eye, but it damaged the optic nerves in the left, and it blinded him. And when Ryan was told that he was going to be blind permanently for life, his statement was, well, if I'm going to be blind, I'm going to be the best damn blind man there is. And that's how he went forward. And Ryan and I just had these kindred spirits that we were going to overcome, that we were going to live life greatly, we were going to lift up the people around us. And Ryan went out to do all these amazing things. He ended up marrying one of his nurses. He ended up getting a job. He ended up getting his degree. He was a mentor for all these other wounded warriors that were out there. He went hunting through a great organization called Camp Patriot and shot an elk. He took off, flew, and landed an airplane. I mentioned he was blind.
Yeah.
He climbed Mount Rainier, and then in 2009, Ryan was having a surgery in Phoenix, and they killed him. They overdosed him. And it devastated me to know how hard it is to overcome these injuries and how far Ryan had come. His wife was expecting when it happened also. But it made me realize in that moment that you have to live life greatly. You cannot push something till tomorrow, because you never know when that day is coming. So you got to have that balance. Life's about balance. It's about taking care of the friends and family that you have, embracing those relationships as you drive down that road, whether you're a SEAL, whether you're a policeman, whether you're a teacher, it doesn't matter. We're all the same as humans. And that's what I want to create in this book. I close the Trident with these six tenets. It's based off all the hard lessons I've learned, reduced to six things that I now follow based off the short but very event-packed life that I've lived in these 40 years. The most important one is overcome. This is the basis of it all. If you are not willing to overcome, to step up and crush adversity, to put one foot in front of the other, regardless of what's in your path, in my opinion, nothing else really matters. You can be a great leader, a great member of a team, you can be the smartest guy out there. If you're not willing to overcome the adversity in your path, none of those things matter. It's amazing what you can accomplish with a tenacious mind. There's nothing in life that cannot be overcome if you're genuinely willing to try and never quit. Always remember, though, it may not be the outcome you wanted or hoped for, but with a mindset to lift up those around you, to always drive forward, be a leader, be a mentor, you'll be a victor and not a victim. Live greatly. Always stay positive. Lift up those around you. Like Ryan, go climb a mountain. Jump from a perfectly good airplane. Live every day like it's your last, and never pass up on life's opportunities that are out there. There's just way too many of them. Too many people never do anything because they're afraid. They're afraid of the unknown. They're afraid that it may not go right. They're afraid of failure. So what? What do you got to lose? Get out there and live. Love deeply. In the end, the only thing you will have left is the relationships you forged and sustained in life. Stay humble. Live in proof. Pride has destroyed more men than all wars combined. I'm lucky enough that I got a second chance. A lot of other people out there have destroyed careers, failed marriages because they let their pride get in the way. Lead always. True leaders lead at all times, regardless of the situation they are in or who may be watching. Lastly, live a life with no regrets. Life is a series of decisions, one continuous balancing act. Always take a few seconds to think through the impact of your decisions. What really may happen if I take the red pill or the blue pill? If you follow these principles when your hour is called, and I assure you that that day is coming for all of us. There's one guaranteed thing in this life, and that is we all have an end date. But if you live your life in this manner that I try to live by these six tenets, you can go knowing I had no regrets. I did it right. I'm Jason Redman. I'm the author of The Trident, a humble man who has been forged and reforged by the fires of adversity, who has had the great honor to serve with one of the greatest warriors our nation has produced, the Navy SEAL teams, and I thank you for having me.
Couple questions?
Absolutely.
All right. Who goes first?
Yeah. Yes. Could you tell me why you were heckled for being a SEAL at Ranger School?
You know, there is a friendly rivalry throughout the military, regardless of what it is. You know, there's the rivalry between the Army and Navy, the rivalry between the Navy and the Marine Corps. Everybody makes fun of the Air Force for some reason, which it's funny. My sister serves in the Air Force, and obviously the Air Force saved my life, so she never fails to remind me of that at all times now. But within Special Operation, there's probably even a tighter rivalry between the Green Berets and the SEALs and the Rangers. And I think it's an unfortunate thing. For a while there, pre-9/11, the SEALs have always been a very close-knit, kind of a secluded group, and I think sometimes that was viewed as standoffishness. And unfortunately, there were some guys out there that fed that mindset, and I think that created some animosity over the years. So a lot of the Rangers, Some of the Ranger instructors that I met didn't really like SEALs, and they didn't really like the fact that I was there. Thankfully, you know, I won a lot of them over. In the end, I didn't help the situation in the beginning because I had such a bad attitude. I fed into that mindset. I fed into that belief that they had. But later turned the tide and showed, hey, look, I have the ability to lead, I have the ability to follow, and I have the ability to work with. And I learned a lot. I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot of great lessons and worked with some great men. And I have the utmost respect for anybody that's ever attended Ranger School and the Ranger battalions that are out there taking the fight to the enemy. Yes, sir.
Did the selfishness of the platoon leader is partially responsible for Bergdahl's capture in Afghanistan 5 years ago?
Do I believe that?
Yeah.
I don't know the story behind the selfishness of the platoon leader. You know, here's the deal in that, and this is my own personal opinion. This is not the opinion of the SEAL teams I am no longer in. Regardless of the circumstances that surrounded that, regardless of the inner dynamics of that platoon, there's been hundreds of thousands of individuals that have served our great nation from the time of the Continental Army all the way up to our current veterans and warriors that serve today. Hundreds of thousands of them have been assigned posts to hold security, to do what they need to do. And despite fear, despite being uncomfortable, despite being hot, despite not having air conditioning, despite all the adversity that they've been faced, the vast majority didn't get up and leave their post. Bergdahl made a decision in that moment that he, for whatever reason, and I'm not going to hypothesize why that was, he decided he was going to get up and leave his post. That's what I have issues with. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that's called desertion. So regardless of the relationship he had with his platoon leader, there are other ways he could have dealt with it besides from wandering off from his post into the outback of Afghanistan to get himself captured.
What are your personal thoughts on the situation in Iraq today?
You know, Iraq's a really tough situation. It's hard to watch right now, obviously. We lost friends there. Obviously, I was wounded there. Iraq was an interesting place. I personally think that 200 years of being under a repressive regime, I think caused the people to not step up and be leaders. They were so used to being told what to do and how to live their life that I think it bred this culture of never taking the initiative. So we really had a hard time when we were over there working with the individuals we were with, trying to really identify people as leaders. And a lot of times we had to push these guys along to make things happen. And many times we just had to do it in order for it to happen. So although I know a lot of people say, did we leave too early? Maybe or maybe not. But the bottom line is this. I do felt that the Iraqi people would have never stepped up and started trying to protect themselves. Their army and their security forces never would have done that if we had not finally said, look, we're no longer here to hold your hand. You guys have to do it. It's unfortunate watching what's going on. But what I do hope is that we have trained them. We have provided the equipment. I do hope they regroup because they have the ability. And I like to see that a couple of days ago, some of the local sheikhs, just like in the Anbar Awakening, started to step up and say, hey, look, we're not going to stand for this. We need to assemble as a country and fight back. My only concern is it too late? You know, did the insurgency get such a strong attack? You know, so I don't know what the answer is. I do know that we can only provide people the services as a nation to try and enable them to have their freedom. You know, we can't go in there and do it for everybody. We can provide you as much as, you know, it's the old adage, give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man a fish, he eats for a lifetime. We taught the Iraqis to fish. They now need to catch it and support themselves.
Jason, I have a question from the internet from Rick in Mundelein, Illinois. You kind of went into this, but this is maybe a different way of you addressing this. This person's in the Navy, and they have a shipmate who came home from Afghanistan a changed man and not in a good way. For somebody in that particular position, what would you suggest to say to him or to help him?
I think he needs to find others that have been in situations that he's been in. I think the biggest problem a lot of our warriors that are struggling so much are facing is they think that they're the only ones. And at times when they get out into American society, that may be true. A lot of their inner circle of friends and family have not experienced the fires of combat or have not experienced the things they may have seen or may have been a part of over there. But there are a lot of guys out there that have. You know, so look for organizations, whether it's the American Legion or Veterans of Foreign Wars. Go there and find some of those individuals. The absolute worst thing you can do is to wall yourself off, because that's when guys start to spiral down, and I think that's what directly leads to suicide.
Any other questions? One more? All right. We'll take two more after.
Okay.
I just had a question. Sort of about as a former Naval Special Warfare officer, and I hope this doesn't violate OPSEC or anything, but I was just wondering, since, you know, I guess the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have kind of dwindled down, at least for Naval Special Warfare, are the SEAL teams going to be refocusing back into more waterborne operations as they have in the past, or are they still going to be, you know, more land-based and focus on sort of counterinsurgencies like they have in the past few years? Thank you.
I think that, you know, the SEAL teams are always, they are the nation's premier maritime special operations force. So we will always go back to the water. It's what we do. 75% of the world's countries have water around them. So Iraq and Afghanistan obviously didn't have large bodies of water. Our focus was on those countries, so we became very land-based in that arena. But I have no doubt, as those wars wind down, we will go back to the very roots that made us who we are. It's what makes the SEAL team special. We have the ability to fight in any environment, but what makes us separate from any other special operation force in the United States military is our ability to come from the water to execute any level of mission.
Last question.
Yep. I just want to say thanks for your service and everything you've done for the country, as well as all the rest of the service people out there. And a question to you is, after you're done with all your training as a Navy SEAL, what is the average years of service of a Navy SEAL? And I was just wondering if you knew any of the members from Team 6 that took out Osama bin Laden, if they are still in service today or retired.
The first question, the average time. You know, we're a unique group. Our retention is pretty darn good. Most guys, I'd say probably 70% do a 20-year career. And we have a smaller group that'll get out. You have a very small amount that'll only do one tour. And then you'll have a smaller group that may do two tours and then get out. But once they make it past that, almost everybody stays for 20. As for your other question, you know, the community as a whole is really trying to get away from numbers, talking about numbered teams, talking about things like that. It's an unfortunate fact that this administration wanted to shine light on specific individuals or groups that do things. You'll notice in my book, I never mention a single number or where I came from, because we don't want to highlight individuals that could possibly create, you know, information flows back to those individuals, who they are, what they do. So I'm going to decline to answer the second question.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, guys.
Thank you to Jason Redmond for joining us today. And thank you to the Marin Electric Company and Wounded Wear for sponsoring this program. The book is The Trident, The Forging and Reforging of a Navy SEAL Leader. To learn more about the book or Jason's other projects, visit jasonredmondww.com. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, download audio podcasts, view additional content, become a member, and explore all the museum and library has to offer. Visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. If you would like to be a part of our studio audience, become a member, or learn more, visit PritzkerMilitary.org. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.